Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. today. Coming up, that conversation with Pastor Will Wheaton on Constantine. We jump ahead in this hour a little bit to the 8th century. Through the 12th century, we're going to take off a big bite of church history with Ted Byfield here for the next hour of Issues Etc. Monday on the program, another rare opportunity, Joyce Meyer has agreed, at least at this point, to do an interview with us on her new book, Addiction Approval. We'll be talking with her on the program. And then coming up in the next hour today, hour three, the theology of the cross and worship. Dr. Mike Horton of the White Horse Inn will be our guest. Ted Byfield is general editor of the Christian History Project, and he joins us to talk about Christianity. Well, I don't even know what to call this age, from the 8th century through the 12th century. Ted, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be back.
What would you call this period in Christian history?
Well, it's the early Middle Ages, of course, but as a period, it doesn't have a name. It's a long, this volume in our series actually covers a longer period of time than any other volume will cover. It goes for 350 years. It raises a lot of questions and issues which we're still living with. Sometimes for the first time they're coming up then. But it doesn't have a name. And it ends in 1100, which just is at the very beginning of the Crusades, which of course has a name. So that's its period. The other thing that's interesting is that it covers the end of the first millennium, and we're living at the end of the second millennium. So that there's a connection there. And I think at the end of the first millennium, our status as Christians could hardly be worse. It was a terrible, things looked really bleak at that time, if we had been looking back on our sort of forebears, we would have said, my gosh, we're going to lose this game because Christianity looked like it was about to be wiped out. And actually, in the second millennium, it spread all over the world. So no matter how grim things look, and some people in North America think they look pretty grim now when you consider the sort of lifestyles we see going on around us, it looked much worse then, and we came through it, and that's kind of encouraging.
Before we get to specifics, let's talk about the turn of the millennium, if you could. You've already told us a little bit about it, but what was the expectation of the church at the time when the first year 1000 rolled around? What were Christians, from what we can tell of the writings and the activities of the church at the time, what were they expecting?
Well, there were some, just as there were at the end of the second millennium, who expected the end of the world or something approaching it, because of the, I guess you could say, superstition around the numeral 1000. So you did have people saying, well, this will be the end of everything, and Christ will return, and the second coming will occur, and that kind of thing. Some people said that, but most did not expect that. But what they had to face up to was the fact that all the sort of founding Christian countries, which would be Palestine, Syria, much of what's now Turkey, the whole of, well, Egypt, for instance, North Africa, these had all once been big Christian countries, and all of them had been taken over by Islam, so that we had lost really more than a third of Christian, if you like to think of it that way, of Christian territory to the south. And then to the north, we had the Vikings, the era, they had destroyed most of the Christian settlements in Ireland and along the coast of England and northern France and that sort of thing. And they were just at 1000 beginning to turn to Christianity themselves. But it was a very near thing. And in the east, the Slavic peoples were not, certainly what's now Russia, were not Christian. So that we had the barbarians coming in from the east and from the north, and we lost everything to the south. That was what made people at that time rather pessimistic.
And we also have right there at near the year 1000 a significant, at least kind of the final stages of the significant split between the Church of the East and the Church of the West, don't we?
Yes, it occurs. The split occurs in 1054. At least that's usually the date they put to it. But it had been growing for hundreds of years. The problem was that the Western Church, spoke Latin, and the Eastern Church spoke Greek. And the Eastern Church regarded the Pope as first among equals. They didn't argue whether he was descended, the throne was descended from Peter, but they did say that Peter was not really the boss of the other disciples in the time of the New Testament, so that his successor, if you like to look at it, and that's the way they did look at it, is no more the boss of all the other bishops. This was at the core of the controversy, and it still is, because the Eastern Church still does not accept the sort of overall authority of the Pope over doctrine and over the administration of the Church. They don't today, and they didn't then. But the trouble with it was that as these forces came against us, we were divided. Now, division itself, if we could have looked forward to what's going on today, the most Christian country in the world is called the United States of America in terms of participation and church and so on. And it has hundreds of churches. It doesn't have a Christian unity in the sense of the central authority. And it's more Christian than any other country, so that maybe this idea of having to have a unified administration over all Christians isn't that good an idea. But at the time, it looked like a disaster.
Explain to us, and this is very difficult for us to grasp, I think, in the first part of the 21st century, and especially since the so-called age of terrorism has dawned upon us so quickly, a world without Islam at first, and then, there in the 7th century, the exponential and rapid growth and spread of Islam and the threat that it posed to Christendom. Try to give us some perspective there.
Well, we mustn't, first of all, we've got to realize that two things. One is that the intent of Islam, that is its policy, is to take over the governments of the world. They believe that this is what God wants them to do. They don't think of themselves as being evil in doing that. They think of themselves as being righteous in doing that. So that we're contending with a movement that is a political movement as well as a spiritual movement. And Christianity has never really settled that question of who, I mean, should we know that Christ told us to go to the ends of the earth, baptizing in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, but whether he told us to do it at the point of a sword is very, very debatable. It certainly doesn't sound like it. And whereas the Muslim believes that's fine. That's one of the ways we have to do it. So that we're up against, as we were in the year 1100, so in the year of the 21st century, we're up against the same idea. And it's a very powerful idea that Christendom has never suffered the reversal since or before that it suffered with the rise of Islam. I mean, we look back in our century and say, well, look at what happened with the rise of Marxism in Russia, and it took over a great part of the world and so on. But it's going. It's gone. You see what I mean? It lasts 100 years and it's gone. Nothing. They have lasted a long time, as you say, since the 7th century, and they're still there and they're still active. And unless we understand that what we're opposing here is a religion that is determined to politically assume the control of the world, we're going to make a mistake, because that's one of the reasons to study history, is just exactly who are these people and what are they out to do? Well, we know what they're out to do because they say so. Now, having understood that, then what do we do about it? Then that's a big argument, you know, whether Bush is right or he's wrong, and whether he doesn't want to call it a religious war, and you can hardly blame him, but that's what it is.
Did the Christians of the during the era of the rise of Islam, did they understand the goals of Islam clearly?
Not at all. You see, there were divisions among the Christians that had taken a pretty fierce effect upon people. And when the Muslim armies arrived at the borders of Egypt, the Coptic Church there, the Egyptian Church, almost welcomed them. Some did, because they had been under heavy persecution from Constantinople, which was the sort of successor Roman Empire, trying to bring them into line theologically. And they, oh, well, these guys are here now. That's great. We can get them. They won't put these others down. They didn't realize at all that when these fellows arrived, what they had in mind was the eradication of Christianity because they thought it a false doctrine. So that we sort of missed the implication when it really mattered. Now, the Egyptian church ever since then has been suffering for that mistake. It exists. Only with the acquiescence of the Muslim regime, and from time to time that regime becomes very, very hostile to it. So then we made a mistake. In other words, no, we didn't realize then that what we were up against. And the same was true in Syria to a lesser degree. And not until it happened so fast, you see. It all occurred within really 30 or 40 years. And suddenly, all these huge Christian lands, land of Augustine, are just gone, and they're not going to come back. Even Spain was taken over, so that we miscalled.
So, as you described it in the very beginning of our conversation, by the time you hit about 750, you've got a good part of Western Europe, that is Spain, occupied by Islam.
Exactly. Constantinople immediately threatened all the time. The other thing that I didn't understand until we actually came to produce that volume, I thought of the Muslim sort of aggression and conquest has pretty well stopping in 750 and the Crusades occurring as they did 300 or so years later as a counterattack 300 years late. But that's not what happened. What happened, the Islam throughout that 300 period kept persistently trying to take over Europe. They took over Sicily. They took over Corsica, Sardinia. They took over southern France. Marseille was in their possession for a long time. And they kept pressure on Constantinople that whole time. They took over most of the Aegean islands. And they attacked Rome itself three times over that period. So that it's not as though you had the Islamic aggression and then a period of relative peace and then the Christian counterattack. You had in that 300-year period, Islam, true to its intention, wanted to take over the rest of the world. That it felt that that's what they were supposed to do. And they made a great effort to do it. So that the Crusades were merely a recognition of the fact that if we don't take over them, they're going to take over us. Now, whether that is a fact or not, I don't know, but it was certainly an understandable position. That's why they launched them.
Let's talk about the rise and the beginnings of monasticism as a formal institution within the church, and then, of course, it is an institution that comes in a large degree, as the book suggests, to shape society, too, to shape culture and government and everything else. Talk about monasticism.
Well, one thing we should realize, and C.S. Lewis makes this point, and that is that those Christians who are most concerned about the next world, and we're not talking now about monks, we're talking about born-again Christians like the people we know or are. A Christian has his eyes fixed on heaven. That's true of Protestants, particularly true of evangelical Protestants. That's where we're going. Now, it's not as though they don't worry about the world, but that this world is not their main contention at all. Now, the irony is that it is these very Christians most concerned about the next world, and that's the monks in their day. We could call it the zealous evangelicals, and all of us know them, and thank heaven they're there. That we see in our day, these are the people who have the greatest effect on our world now. The monks didn't care about our world much. They were worried about the next. But what they in fact did was lay the foundations of the world we're living in. They didn't even want to do that. They didn't know they were doing that, but that's what they were doing. God, we presume, who sees these things and can see ahead, knew what they were doing. They didn't.
Is it fair to say that monasticism came to, by the end of the period we're talking about here, this 300-400 year period, by the beginning of at least the 12th century, came to really shape what the church was all about as well?
Well, what it did, it it cleansed the church, or the church, any church, whether we're talking about the Roman Catholic Church or we're talking about the Methodist Church or the Episcopal Church, they go through waves. That is, there are periods of intense reform when we look at what's going on and we say, we're not living in the right way, we've got to change this. And so we do, and there's a great fervor, and the churches expand, and we bring new people in. But that fervor begins to wane and ebb. It invariably does, and at that point, then the problems begin to arise again, whether we're talking about problems of paying no attention at all to evangelism, or the problems of sexual license, and priests that abuse kids, and all this sort of thing. That kind of problem has been chronic in Christianity, and it certainly occurred among the monastic movement. What happened when the movement really got underway, and it goes all the way back to the time of Antony in the desert, but it goes through waves of change. You see, there'll be a period when it's all of a sudden men and women from all over the place decide that this is the way they want to serve Christ, and it's a good thing to do. Big monasteries are established and movements are established, like the Franciscans or the Dominicans and so on. They have a tremendous effect. They're very, very good people by any standard, but they go down. And then what happens a couple of hundred years later, another great wave occurs. But in those days, I mean, if you really wanted to serve Christ, what we do now is we change the way we live and we change the way our families run and we become ardent members of churches, and we take them very seriously, and we say our prayers very consistently. And that's what we do now. What people did then is said, well, if I really want to commit myself to Christ, I should become a monk or a nun, and they did. So that while the form of their service was certainly quite a bit different, the motive for doing it was exactly the same. And it had a huge effect on, just from a physical point of view, it restored the agricultural basis of Europe, the monks particularly. I mean, Europe was a shambles. I mean, the barbarians had destroyed the aqueducts and everything else. They began putting the agricultural basis back together. They drained the lands and they developed new methods of agriculture. But they did this not because they cared that much about what it was doing for the world. They thought, this is what I'm doing for God. I'm taking care of this little garden here, and I'm growing beets or something. And I've noticed that if I put the beets in this way and not that way, or if I fertilize them this, it's much better. That's what occurred, and it occurred. It was going on all over Europe, led by men and women who wouldn't get married, and in so doing, they really restored the agricultural basis of Europe, which was a myth. We weren't going to be starving anymore. And that kind of thing, and it went on for a long, long time, always fading down and then being renewed, and new people come in and they get it going again. Now that is the course of Christian history, and we can see it in the monastic movement, and we can see it in the evangelical movement. We do the same thing. You know, the Great Awakening in the early history of the United States was one of the most moving and thrilling Christian experiences. It just changed the whole shape of history, not just the history of the United States, the history of the world. They didn't know they were doing that. They just thought, we're going to serve Christ, and this is what we're going to do. And suddenly, great changes began to occur. And that's one of the qualities of the Christian experience.
Ted Byfield is our guest. We're talking about Christianity from 740 through 1100, thereabouts. And he is general editor of the Christian History Project. Before we go on here, Ted, tell us about the Christian History Project. What is it?
Well, it's really a lot of people, and I we're mostly journalists, realize that most Christians do not know the Christian story. They are familiar with two centuries. That is the first century and the life of Christ and the ministry of Christ, our Lord, and the apostles. They're very familiar with. They know a great deal, for instance, about a certain Roman governor in Jerusalem named Pilate. They know a lot of, they know that section, and they know the 20th and the 21st century very well. They can see in the elections and so on where big religious issues are being involved here, and they involve themselves in those issues. So we're conversant. What we don't know is how we got from the one to the other, the 19 or 20 centuries in between. And In that, a whole lot of things happened that were of vital importance to what's going on now. So we've got to make people aware of Christian history. They've got to see that we're not a movement that sort of started in 100 years ago. We've got a huge past here, and we're all one big family. That definitely comes through. Most of us think the same way all through those periods. We make the same assumptions, and we have the same assumptions about life, and we have some incredible stories and experiences. We said we're going to tell these stories. We're journalists. We tell stories. We're going to make sure they're as accurate as we can, so we've recruited a team of academic historians to check everything we write. We're going to illustrate them as effectively as we can, because there was no photography then, so we're going to have to put together a lot of new art, and of course some of the historic art along with it. And we're going to put these in books first, and then we're going to get it on television, and we're going to say, look at to the Christian people, here's your family, here's who you are, profit by their experience, because their experience, our experience, 100, 200, 500, 700 years ago, can be very, very pertinent today if you know what happened. So we said, we're going to tell them what happened, and that's what we're doing in a series of books, which we've been selling in various ways all over Canada and the United States.
If you want to know more about the Christian History Project, go to ChristianHistory.com. It's ChristianHistory.com, or contact them at 1-800-853-5402. That's 1-800-853-5402.
Yeah, one last point there. It's the Christian History Project.com.
ChristianHistoryProject.com. Thank you very much for correcting that. Hit ChristianHistoryProject.com. Ted, we've got about 30 seconds here before we go to this first break here. Get us started on the towering figure of this period, that is Emperor Charlemagne.
Well, he was a born-again Christian. There's no question about that. He was a politician and a king with enormous power, and he said, how can I make my government do what our Lord Jesus Christ would want it to do? And he set out to do that, and to a degree, he did accomplish a lot, and it didn't work. That's the story.
When we come back, we'll go deeper into that story of Charles the Great, Charlemagne. Entire period of history is marked by his influence, and we'll be talking about it when we come back. We're talking about Christianity from 740 to 1100. Ted Byfield, general editor of the Christian History Project, is our guest. In the third hour of the program today, the theology of the cross and worship. How do the two go together? Dr. Mike Horton will join us from the White Horse Inn. We'll be talking about that there in hour three of Issues Etc. today. Ted Byfield is our guest. Again, the number for contacting the Christian History Project is 1-800-853-5402, 1-800-853-5402, or go to the web, ChristianHistoryProject.com, ChristianHistoryProject.com. Tomorrow on the program, Paul Robbie joins us for a conversation on the prophecies in Daniel. Then Monday, Joyce Meyer, she joins us for a conversation on her new book, Approval Addiction. When we come back, 25 more minutes in this second hour, talking about Christianity from 740 to 1100 with Ted Byfield, general editor of the Christian History Project. We'll also get into some of the political conflicts that arose after the world comes in conflict with the church. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Ted Byfield is our guest for another 25 minutes as we talk about Christianity from A.D. 740 through 1100. He's general editor of the Christian History Project. You know, if you were interested in this kind of thing, part and parcel of a Christian worldview is a thorough and careful understanding of your own history. I think Ted's right when he says before the break that this is our history. This is not just the history of some far-off distant people, history of people who are distant from us in both time and location. No, this is our history. This is Christian history. Part and parcel of a Christian worldview is a complete understanding of Christian history. And for a better understanding of the Christian worldview, I can do no better than to recommend a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar at the Schwann Center this summer in Trago, Wisconsin. The Schwann Center is about 2 hours north of the Twin Cities. This summer, this conference is held as it is every summer. And this summer, they have three Issues Etc. regular guests: Dr. Gene Edward Veith of World Magazine, Dr. Alvin Schmidt, author of the book Under the Influence, How Christianity Transformed the West, and then also Dr. Angus Manoogian. He's recently edited that book called Reading God's World, Science as a Vocation. They're all going to be there at a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar this summer at the Schwann Center in Trego, Wisconsin. For more information, go to our website and look for the Schwann Center logo, issuesetc.org, or just call the Schwann Center at 1-800-577-4848, 1-800-577-4848. Ted, you gave us a very brief beginning on Charlemagne. Now give us the longer story.
Okay. Well, he emerges out of the Frankish kingdoms, which were ruthlessly, they were awful kings, his predecessors. They're dreadful people, but they gradually, they're sort of the ancestors of the modern Germans and French. There was murder within the royal families and all this kind of thing, poisoning. It was terrible, but they gradually became more and more influenced by the gospel of Christ, the same one that you and I know of. And they said, you know, some of them said, we ought not to be living like this. We say we're Christians. Why don't we try living like Christians? And it descends through one branch of their royal family to this young man that we know as Charles the Great, Charlemagne. And as he took over this kingdom, he was a very, very clever general and politician. There's no question about this. But he said, I have the opportunity here to create a Christian society, and I'm going to try to do it. Now, that's the same idea that the Pilgrim Fathers had when they arrived in North America. We have the idea. Wonder how we're going to do this. So he used to sleep, they said, with Augustine's City of God under his pillow, because Augustine had said, well, here's what a Christian society would be like. So he set out to build it. And everything went wrong. But for instance, the Saxons to the north, which were unconverted German people, would promise that they would behave themselves and quit murdering each other and everybody else, and he'd accept their word for it. And then they wouldn't do it, and they would behave just exactly as they always had. Christians today, you know, we have people, we from time to time try to say, look, at why don't you try living this way instead of that? And they say, okay, yeah, I'll do that. Give me a bit of money. And then what do? They go back and behave the same way. He had this, but on a massive scale, so that he spent his entire life trying to shape the law as he thought Christ would have it be, and trying to govern as he thought Christ would want a king to govern. And in the end, it didn't work. That is, his successors, who shared some of his zeal, not all of it, allowed everything to go back to the way it had been before. And so I suppose if Constantine came to the end of his life, he would have considered himself a failure. But he wasn't a failure, because he set up ideas, he put precedents into the law that in another generation people looked back and they said, you know, he had the right idea. Why don't we try that again? And then it began to work. So that we can't see, I guess, in our lives whether we succeeded or we didn't. You have a mother who spends a lot of time trying to raise two or three kids, and she dies when she's in her 40s or 50s, and they haven't made up them done that well, maybe badly. She thinks she's failed. She dies, and one or two of those kids become great Christians. She doesn't know that. But we have to believe in another world, she does know it. That was what Charlemagne did. He was a man who devoted his life in a very, very cleverly to try to make a Christian world. Didn't succeed. Died a failure, but really was not a failure.
So to what degree did the Carolingian time, especially the time of Charlemagne himself, become for subsequent generations kind of a golden era to which they would aspire? Okay. It didn't last past Charlemagne, but maybe we can recapture it. Maybe
well,
we can even
Well, what
outdo
happens
it.
Is you go through about 100 years, and then there's another king turns up in the same area who shares Charlemagne's view, and begins to establish a monarch, the what becomes what we call the Holy Roman Empire, on a basis that Charlemagne would have approved of, and then the civilization, if you want to call it that, of central Europe, west, we'd say Western Europe, begins to take shape on a much stronger and solid basis, acting on the principles that Augustine established.
Was part of his massive influence the fact that he had a very, very long tenure as emperor and king?
Oh, yeah, and the other thing was, the big thing was his interest in education. He began establishing schools and that kind of thing that did survive to some degree. And he said, we can't have Christians that don't know anything about Christianity. This is quite wrong. And therefore, he encouraged the establishment of the monastery schools and the cathedral schools, as they later became, and the idea that a Christian should know how to read, you know, because you can't read the Bible if you can't read. And these ideas permeated into Western culture, and gradually the tribes that he had the most trouble with, the Saxons, became the champions of Christianity and Christian education. And it was they, if it was from among them, oddly enough, three or four generations later, that the leadership came to establish what he set out to do. And at the time that he was alive, they were the worst problem. You know, you never know.
Okay, then let's talk about something you mentioned very early in our conversation, and that is the Vikings and their role. You mentioned before that we've got Islam pressing from the east, pressing from the south, pressing at least in Spain, in upon Western Christendom from all those directions. And then also another menace to the north. Tell us about it.
Well, the Vikings, as we know, are these what we now call the Scandinavians. That's where they came from. And they were probably, given the technology of the time, they were probably the greatest sailors the world has ever known. I don't mean that they could sail farther and faster, but because new technologies, of course, did come along. But in terms of just the raw essentials of the seaman's mind, you know, they had it, and they got all this people from really a barbarous north got all over the world. They certainly crossed the Atlantic. They created a colony in Greenland. They took over Iceland, Greenland. They came down the coast. We don't know how far down they got. They certainly got to Newfoundland. They may have got down as far as New Jersey and Georgia. Then in the other direction, they got into they crossed the Baltic, went up the rivers flowing into the Baltic, found that those rivers flowed, they crossed the sort of height of land, got those rivers that flowed south into the Black Sea and the Caspian, and they were down there, all around there. At one point, they attacked and took Constantinople very briefly. And then they sailed through into the Mediterranean through Gibraltar Straits and so on, and all over the world they went. And they killed. They stole and they killed. That's what they were brutal people. And they'd go further than that. They tortured. They'd take prisoners aboard the ships and tear them to pieces methodically as a form of entertainment. The people were absolutely terrified. There was a line in the old litany of the what became the Anglican Church, you know, from the fury of the Vikings, good Lord, deliver us. Now, these same people became Christians. And one of the great stories is the story of King Alfred in England. You know, he fought them down, beat them. And Guthrum, the Swedish, the Danish king, who was opposing him, waits to be torn to pieces. There are various ways that you take care of people that you've defeated, and he was expecting this to happen. Instead of this, Alfred says, no, I have a different punishment for you, and he baptizes him. And Guthrum, unlike the Saxons, Guthrum was as good as his word, and he never attacked England again and became quite a dedicated, devoted Christian. And Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton, in the last century, makes a magnificent poem of Alfred's defeat of the Vikings. And it's a book-length poem, and it's a whole book, and it's got great lines in it. I remember at one point Alfred's praying because he says, everything's going wrong. What can you give for me? And the answer, it comes from the Virgin. He has a picture of the Mary and a vision of her. And she says, the men of the East may spell the stars and times and triumphs mark, but the men signed with the cross of Christ go gaily in the dark, you know. Well, how many people today, Christians, trying to do something, everything's going wrong. You remember a thing like that, you know. You remember gaily in the dark. We don't know what's going to happen, but we've got no reason to be sad. Smarten up, brighten up. This is the kind of thing that comes through that poem, as applicable today as it was for Alfred.
Ted, we've talked about the Vikings here. We've talked about Islam. We've talked about monasticism. We've talked about Charlemagne. One of the things we haven't discussed here, except peripherally, is what's going on in the Eastern Church. We did discuss the Great Schism there a little bit, but what's going on in the East, in its theology, that is bringing about some disruption there in that part of the empire, and that eventually contributes to the split between East and West?
Yeah, we can discuss that, but we don't want to miss the story of Vladimir. It's a love story, you know, and it's historical. And it's a great story. I think we should make sure we tell
it. Well, why don't you go ahead and tell that story, then we'll talk about the East.
Okay. Tell me, you ask me a question, and we'll...
Okay. Who is Vladimir, and what significance does he play in this period in history?
Well, Vladimir was one of the Vikings. At least he was descended from them. And I said that some of them went up the rivers that flowed into the Baltic over the height of land and came down the rivers that flow to the Black Sea. One of them they came down was a Dnieper, and it is the city of Kiev, and Vladimir and the Vikings. It was very strange, you see, because the Slavic peoples actually invited the Vikings to come in, and they said, we'll work for you because we're lousy fighters, but we're good workers. And they actually took them on and brought them in as kings. And one of the queens they brought was a woman named Olga, Viking name. And she became Christian, but she couldn't do anything about her subjects because they were so hopelessly pagan. Her son was a great disappointment to her, but her grandson was named Vladimir. He was a very handsome guy, and he had a great many wives, women, and everything else. Lived a pretty loose life like the Vikings always did. But the other Slavic peoples to the east of him were all becoming, to the west of him, were all becoming Christians. And he said, I'm just not going to be able to hold this my little kingdom together, which is, he ruled the people called the Rus, R-U-S, from which we get Russian, of course. And he said, I'm going to have to become Christian. It was a purely political thing. He would become Christian because that was the politic thing to do. So he thought about this, and he read a lot about it, and he became very, very interested, from a more historical point of view, on the man called Jesus. He said, this fellow was, there was something about him, and he became fascinated with him beyond the political. Anyway, at about that time, the emperor of the Eastern Empire was in bad trouble, and he knew that Vladimir had soldiers that he had nothing to do with at the moment. They were all Vikings. And he said, if you send me, the emperor had a rebellion he had to deal with. He said, if you send me a contingent of troops down, that would be a very nice thing, and I'll owe you a favor. That's really what would you like me to do for you? And Vladimir said, well, I'm becoming a Christian, and I'm going to have a Christian wife, and I'd like to have a little status, so I'd prefer to marry your sister. Well, the emperor said, okay, you can have my sister. We now have a treaty here. He sent the troops put down the rebellion. Vladimir waits at the big portage on the Dnieper, the rapids, it's still there, waits for his bride to come. Instead, there's two or three bureaucrats from the imperial government say, we're sorry to have to tell you this, sir, but she refuses to marry a barbarian. So he's furious. He goes down, lays siege to the big imperial city on the Black Sea, Cherson, near what's now Sevastopol, and he takes it. He conquers it, and the people are terrified because they know the Viking reputation. And he enters the city with his soldiers, finally having taken it, and they wait to be killed and robbed and raped and everything. I can't do that anymore because I'm a Christian. All I want is my wife. So the emperor the emperor says to his sister, look, you've got to go because we can't, we're going to lose the whole Black Sea. So she reluctantly goes. He meets her. They meet in Cherson. They're married as a Christian marriage. And she, to her absolute amazement, finds him very, very attractive. And they set up at Kiev the first, a really make an effort, like Charlemagne had done, to establish a real Christian community. And he passed all kinds of really extraordinary laws. He even tried at one point to abolish capital punishment, but that was impossible. But he eased all the usual horrible conditions that the prisoners were in, and he set up schools and monasteries, even a hospital, all the things that he thought he should do. And he died. They had two sons, both of whom were very, very good Christians and were both martyred because of their Christianity, because the people didn't swallow it that well, I guess, and things like that. But eventually, of course, the whole of Russia was converted, starting with Vladimir, and it became a very, very Christian country, and still, in spite of 75 years of communist domination, still is a very Christian country. The churches there are packed now. Something in the Russian people makes them very, very spiritual people. They always have been. But it all begins with Vladimir's love affair with this woman he wanted to marry and eventually did. It's a good story, and it's true.
Let's talk about the veneration of icons and the degree to which iconology, some would classify it as idolatry, became contentious in the Eastern Church.
Well, there was no question it became idolatry. The icons were, they weren't just pictures. They were pictures painted in a sort of spiritual way. And they, of the saints, of the apostles and so on, and of course of Jesus and our Lord himself, and that kind of thing. They never tried to portray God the Father. They thought you couldn't do that. Some of them since have, but the icons were mostly of local saints, people who died for the faith and that kind of thing. If they were alive today in the United States, there would be icons of Billy Graham and various people like that. And what they did, what they were supposed to do, according to the proper use of icons, was the picture is supposed to remind you of the person that exists behind the picture, that is, the real person who's there. And you must not, they kept insisting, worship the picture, because the icon is not what the icon's just paint and wood. But gradually people came to make the icon into a sort of semi-god, and there were weird things going on. People were using icons for curing people. They were scraping the paint off icons and eating it because they thought it would cure cancer, and all the terrible stuff went on. And there one of the very, very Christian emperors decided, look, we can't have this. This is just idolatry. So he began to abolish it. A huge fight broke out that went on for 100 years. But in the course of it, people, I think, did come to see that veneration, as they say, of icons could become idolatry very easily, and it was restored, but it was restored on a much more subdued basis, always with warnings, do not worship the icon. But in the course of this, it split everybody. I mean, there were families fighting over it, some on one side, some on the other, and it was a terrible business. It lasted, as I say, for a century.
Let's turn our attention, if we could, just a bit to missionary work into the East. What happened during this period from about 750 through 1100 as Christianity itself moved even past its own eastern borders into the Far East?
Well, there's an incredible story which very few Christians know. There was a heresy condemned by one of the church councils in the 400s called Nestorianism. And it was because there was Nestorius was a bishop, and I'm not sure to this day whether I understand it properly, but he questioned the unity of the Trinity, and it was all to do with the person of Christ and whether he was, in what sense was he God. And Nestorius was thrown out, and a whole church developed around accepting him. And that church was condemned in the Greek Empire, in the Eastern Roman Empire. So it moved east into Persia, where it was accepted, even though the Persians themselves they opposed them, but they were allowed to live there. The Nestorian Church created what is probably the greatest missionary movement in Christian history. They went right through to China. There were hundreds of churches established in northern China. The Mongol peoples, who would later conquer half the world, a lot of them became Christians. And it went, but when they, somewhere around the time of 1100 or 1200, the Mongol peoples arose and eventually became Islamic. And they destroyed the Christian churches in the East. But when the missionaries from the West got there in the 1500s and 1600s, they were astonished to find all the remnants of Christian civilization that had been enormous. Hundreds of thousands of northern Chinese were Christians before the end of the first millennium. And that church was wiped out. Today, there's a little remnant of it remains in Persia. And that's all it came. But it's a thrilling story how they did this, and they lost in the end. They were defeated. But we tend to think of the sort of Orient, the Far East, as being essentially not Christian until the Europeans got there. That's not the case at all. There were huge Christian establishments in northern China. We tell that story in Volume 6.
Ted Byfield is general editor of the Christian History Project. He joined us to talk about Christianity from AD 740 through about 1100. Ted, thank you very much for being our guest, as usual.
Thank you.
You can go to the web and visit the Christian History Project at christianhistoryproject.com, christianhistoryproject, all one word, .com, or call them toll-free, 1-800-853-5402. Now, when we come back, Hour 3 of Issues, Etc. today, Dr. Mike Horton will be our guest. He's host of the White Horse Inn radio program. We'll be talking to him about the theology of the cross and worship, two things that ought to go together. Sad to say, so often in many churches today, they don't go together. Now, Friday on the program, Dr. Paul Robbie will be our guest of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Dr. Robbie will be joining us to talk about prophecies in the book of Daniel. And, of course, that subject always goes far and afield. Then, let's see, Sunday night on the program, the author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, Pastor Clement Preuss, will be our guest. We're going to talk generally about doctrine and practice, the relationship between what you believe and what you practice. That is live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Now, here's something you don't want to miss. This is Monday on the program. She has often been a subject of conversation, whether the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is writing about her and her finances and her ministry, or whether we are reviewing one of her sermons in our regular Issues, Etc. sermon reviews. Joyce Meyer will be a guest on Issues, Etc. Monday. She's written a new book called Approval Addiction, and I have the opportunity to talk with her, ask her some questions, not only about the book, but about what she thinks of the coverage in the press, and also what she really believes. One of the biggest questions I want to answer in that conversation with Joyce Meyer on Monday, and you really do want to tune in for this one, we'll be getting your reaction after the conversation, is, does she consider herself a word faith preacher? She's often classified as one. One listens and one might think that she is one, but does she consider herself a word faith teacher? So that's coming up Monday on the program, our interview with Joyce Meyer on her book, Addiction Approval. When we come back, Dr. Mike Horton and the theology of the cross and worship.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.